So this is the session on the topic of can there be a revolution in the 21st century? My name is Daniel, member of Socialist Alternative, based here in Melbourne. I'll introduce our speaker in a moment. I'm going to be sort of chairing and facilitating this discussion. Before we start, I've got a couple of announcements, a bit different to some of the announcements you may have heard before, if you've been to previous sessions. First of all, the question and answer. Later today, if you look in your program, you'll see a session entitled Every Question You Ever Wanted Answered about Socialist Alternative. Really, it's more about socialism. If you have any questions about socialism, you have anything during the conference that you think hasn't been addressed properly or you want it to get addressed, the way these sessions work is that you can write it down, any thought that you have, any question, any criticism, any contentious idea, and put it in literally in this box, right? It's anonymous. You don't have to put your name on it. And at that session at 2:15 p.m., a panel of esteemed socialists, including Chloe here, will be forced to respond publicly to your questions. But that only works if people write questions. So write the questions down after this session. They're going to be collected in the lunch break, so this is basically the last shot to get them after this. So write them down, put them in here, and then afterwards you can go and see Chloe, see how she deals with it. That's announcement one. Announcement two, so this session's about revolution. Another thing that happens that's also sort of good is an election. There's going to be an election on May 18th, and although we, as Chloe will no doubt explain, definitively do not think that socialism can be introduced in Parliament and indeed must be fought for in a revolutionary process, we want to have a go at participating in this election as socialists to argue for socialism in working class areas, in inner city areas, all around Melbourne, and see if we can get a vote that's recorded, that's a high vote, similar to what we did in the state election last year, that registers, there's tens of thousands of people around Melbourne that want a socialist alternative in politics. That's what it's about, and it's quite an important project. Could make quite a big impact if we can get a good result in the federal election, or better, than we did in the state election. It's part of this project. It's not just our group, Socialist Alternative. We've initiated it with a number of other left-wingers, socialists and allies from around Melbourne. So it's called the Victorian Socialists. We're standing candidates in three different areas. I'm going to pass around here a sign-up sheet if you want to help. So we're going to be doing it in the next week after this conference, a whole series of different activities to promote this, whether it be dropping things in people's letterboxes, explaining that you can vote for socialists in the election, other things like that. It's all sort of listed on here. It's in two different areas, Cooper, which is a division in the election that's sort of more in the inner north, the inner city of Melbourne, but it does go out a little bit to some of the more working class areas in the north of it. The other one is Caldwell, which is a more outer suburb, very working class, set of suburbs, very working class area, the area that if anyone was at the opening night where the factory fire was, or the warehouse fire was discussed, it's an area that was deeply affected by that, for example, and another of other similar fires. Those are the two areas. They're both very important places to promote socialism in, we would argue, and the election is actually a rare opportunity to do that. So we're hoping to get as many volunteers as possible for it. If you do want to take part in it, and I encourage you to do so, make sure you do leave your contact details, otherwise we won't have any way to help you do it. And then at the end of the thing, if you look through, if you want to sign, if you can't do any of that, but you want to find out about future activities that you can help with Victorian Socialists, just sign up as a volunteer right on the end. I'm going to pass that around now, plus some leaflets explaining the nature of the thing. If you've got questions about that, I'm involved in organising it, so after the session you can talk to me and I can help you with it. Okay, now on a totally different topic, revolution. The speaker today will be Chloe Rafferty. Chloe's flown all the way down from Wollongong, where she's a long-standing leading member of Socialist Alternative and the president of that most revolutionary institution, the Wollongong University Students Association, which actually, if you read the Illawarra Mercury, you'll see the Wollongong University Students Association is, under Chloe's leadership, one of the most radical institutions probably on any university campus in Australia currently. So she's done a lot of good practical work, yet to lead a revolution. Hopefully we'll do soon. Chloe's going to introduce the topic, and then afterwards we'll have discussion. Welcome, Chloe.
Okay, so in the year that I was born, 1990, socialist revolution appeared to be decisively and permanently off the agenda. The Cold War had ended with the fall of most of the world's so-called communist regimes and the triumph of capitalist liberal democracies, with the US the unrivaled global superpower. Neoliberalism had established dominance globally with the opening up of even China to international trade. In the West, trade unions were smashed or tamed and integrated into the state. Liberal intellectuals, famously like Francis Fukuyama, triumphantly claimed that it was the end of history. And by this he meant that the battle of ideas had been fought and won by neoliberal capitalist democracies. There would be no longer be conflicts over styles of government or classes or any challenge to capitalism, let alone revolutionary. As Margaret Thatcher famously proclaimed, there is no alternative. And this is her proclaiming, there is no alternative. Today, that liberal myth is long gone. The global financial crisis of 2008 profoundly shook people's faith in the ability of the global market to provide for ordinary people. In the shadow of that catastrophe, a wave of democratic revolutions swept the Middle East in the Arab Spring, which unleashed mass protests and strikes which toppled dictators. Today, governments are increasingly unpopular, illegitimate and authoritarian. From the election of Trump, Brexit, the rise of the far right and struggles against austerity in Europe and the cracking down of popular discontent, like that's what's been seen with the yellow vests. In this context, socialism has re-emerged in the popular consciousness of young workers across the advanced capitalist world. But even in the socialist movement, many argue that the question of revolution is now off the table. From popular politicians like Sanders and Corbyn to popular left-wing journals like Jacobin, reformist socialists argue that the existence of representative democracy in some parts of the world means that revolution is not possible or potentially not even desirable. But socialist alternative argues that a workers' revolution is both possible and necessary to get rid of capitalism. Building a society based on the genuine interests and collectivity, collective democracy of workers requires revolution to defeat the power of the 1% in the boardrooms, the state and civil society. But could there be a revolution in the 21st century? So firstly, revolutions have already happened in the 21st century. I consider just saying that and sitting down, by the way. So this is, unlike Thatcher, this is Ala Asala in Sudan proclaiming the end of the regime. So the revolutionary movements going on today in Sudan and Algeria are confirmation that revolutions still happen. And Algeria and Sudan are not the first. The revolutionary wave in 2011, known as the Arab Spring, shook the foundations of capitalism across the Middle East, toppled dictators and mobilised millions before it was crushed by counter-revolution. I think a look at the inspiring struggle in Sudan today demonstrates some of the key arguments that Marxists make about revolution. So firstly, that it's not socialists don't conjure up revolutions, they emerge from the structural crisis of capitalism. In Sudan, the protests were set off by the lifting of subsidies on bread, wheat and electricity, as well as spiking inflation, which was destroying already poverty-stricken living conditions. The implementation of IMF-prescribed austerity measures had opened up an upsurge of mass struggle, which has already toppled two presidents. The dictator of 30 years, Omar al-Bashir, was overturned by a military coup in response to the mass pressure of rolling protests. And in a single day, the person who replaced him was overthrown as well. As Marx argued, I think another point that's confirmed is that, as Marx argued, every political revolution has a social soul. So the Sudanese movement is not currently raising the demand for socialism, but it is being driven by class struggle. The economic crisis of Sudan is at the heart of the masses' grievances. And class organisations are also at the heart of the struggle, with the Sudanese Professionals Association, a union of doctors, teachers and lawyers, taking the key organising role in the struggle. And importantly, it was the threat of a general strike which finally toppled al-Bashir. Another important point I think that the revolution is raising is that revolutions raise the demands of the oppressed and push them to the fore. So as the Russian revolutionary Lenin famously described revolutions, they are festivals of the oppressed. In Khartoum, the capital of Sudan today, this is palpable. Sudanese women lead the chants in the occupation of the streets, challenging misogynistic stereotypes, breaking repressive sexist laws, and demanding solidarity from men. Protesters have converged on army headquarters and are self-organising a city within a city to defend their protests from violence, organising food and medical assistance. And women marched the day before International Women's Day to demand the release of over 45 women political prisoners, including the leader of the Women's Union. And women and men have both gathered and courageously faced live ammunition and tear gas, breaking down the stereotype of women being fragile and weak. So all of this is very inspiring. But for many leftists in the West, who might be inspired by the revolutionary movements in North Africa, revolution is something that might happen in the global South, but not potentially the rich and supposedly democratic West. Instead, the apparently peaceful strategy of reform is usually posed, the idea of using the vote as a weapon to strip away class society through legislative reform. It's clear that revolutions can happen in the 21st century. The question socialists in the advanced capitalist world need to ask is not so much can they happen, but can revolution happen here, and can a revolution win socialism? But firstly, how we define socialism. So Rosa Luxemburg, the German revolutionary leader, once famously argued that the divide between reform and revolution in the socialist movement wasn't just a matter of different paths to a shared goal, but implied different goals. So what Luxemburg meant by this is that when moderate or reformist socialists argue for a legislative road to socialism, what they're actually arguing for is the surface modification of the existing capitalist society. So reformism accepts the existing framework of the capitalist state, and it takes at face value the proposition that anyone with majority support from the population can capture the state through elections. But there's a difference between governing society and ruling society. Social power and command over society's institutions and the shaping and reshaping of society doesn't just exist in the parliament. Power also lies in the boardrooms, the stock exchange, and the unelected parts of the state, particularly the sections of the state with a monopoly over the use of violence. The 1% have an enormous social power to discipline politicians and to undermine democracy. There's like the obvious influence of political donations, where an army of corporate lobbyists buy influence and votes on important legislation. But there is also things like the threat of withdrawing investment, destabilising the economy, withholding commodities on or locking out workers. When economic sabotage isn't enough, the capitalist class can call on an enormous state bureaucracy to work against elected representatives that threaten their interests. Legislation that threatens profits can be ruled as unconstitutional. So, for example, the ALP's attempts to nationalise the banking sector in 1948. Everyone remembers that? No. Probably the last thing, socialistic-style legislation they've attempted to do. Just last month, it was revealed that British soldiers have been using an image of left-wing leader of the British Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, for shooting practice. And this isn't the first time the British Army has violently threatened the opposition leader. So when Corbyn was first elected Labour leader in 2015, a senior serving general speculated openly in the Daily Mail that the army could stage a mutiny under Corbyn if his reforms threatened the security of the nation. Threats to the security of the nation include not liking nukes. So Corbyn's long-standing opposition to the Trident nuclear program. And since then, Corbyn has capitulated on this position. I don't think he's capitulated because of a general's article in the Daily Mail, but more just the logic of reformism in general. So he now says that his party would renew the nuclear program if elected into government. So despite the massive popularity of the anti-war movement in the UK, and particularly Corbyn's historic anti-war positions, accepting the priorities of British imperialism, including the madness of its nuclear arsenal, is a prerequisite for taking power. The capitalist class are satisfied with an electoral system only so long as it provides a political leadership which can ensure its rule. As Rosa Luxemburg argued a few years before her murder at the hands of reformists in government, it is sheer insanity to believe that capitalists would good-humouredly obey the socialist verdict of a parliament or a national assembly, that they would calmly renounce property, profit, the right to exploit. And I think the renunciation of property, profit, or the right to exploit is a pretty good definition of socialism. So reformism in practice is faced with one of two options when it takes power, either to be crushed by the power of the 1% or to capitulate to it. And more often than not, they capitulate. Accepting the stability of the economy, the profitability of the capitalist class, and the constitutionality of legislation as a limit to what can be reformed. And a quick glance, I think, at the programs and practice of reformist parties throughout history makes this quite clear. So even the Australian Labor Party, one of the most right-wing and decrepit examples of social democracy, once had the socialisation of industry as a formal objective in its political program. So revolutionaries support the struggle for reforms, and this is because they can help to advance the living conditions of workers, and also because the struggle to achieve them can help organise and politicise workers. But our vision of socialism is not a list of legislative reforms. The provision, the nationalisation of industry, the raising of the minimum wage, and expansion of the welfare state. Our vision of socialism is a radical reorganisation of production and society under the collective and democratic control of the working class. What American Marxist Hal Draper called socialism from below. So only workers' control over production can break down the structures of exploitation and alienation that currently govern our society. By capturing our workplaces and transferring decision-making power to the people who collectively produce society's wealth, workers' control can strip away the source of the capitalist class's dominance over society. So Marx argued from the 1840s onwards that workers were capable of making a socialist revolution because they are a class with radical chains. What he meant by this was that workers' position in the system is what gives them both the interest and the ability to bring down capitalism. And this is because workers don't have a stake in the system. They have no private property. They don't have any of the, they might have a car, a house, but they don't have any of the means of production, the factories, the patents, or the mining rights, the equipment, the raw materials to make production happen. And capitalism has brought workers together in huge numbers to cooperate in producing collectively, not just in single workplaces, but in production change which cross the globe. And unlike other oppressed classes of the past, like peasants, when workers rise up collectively, they can only take hold of the means of production collectively. So it would be futile to divide up the equipment, the technology, and commodities of a single workplace between workers in the way that the revolting peasants divide up the land in the past. But in periods of low working class struggle, like Australia today, theories often emerge which want to write off the possibility of radical and revolutionary working class struggle. So when history ended in the 1990s, a popular idea floating around was that the working class doesn't exist anymore. Radical left academics, such as post-Marxist Laclau and Mouffe, authors of Hegemony and Socialist Strategy, argued that the working class was no longer the agent of change or the subject of revolution. And instead of appealing to the self-activity of workers, they argued that socialists should reject a strategy based on class and instead take a populist approach to social identity. They argued that there is no particular layer of society with a collective interest or ability to challenge capitalism, but instead a series of disconnected social interest groups. And this was one of the kind of theoretical foundations for the development of like identity politics and other theories which deny the possibility of solidarity between the oppressed. So in the Western world, reformists raise often contradictory arguments to explain why workers can no longer make a revolution. Workers of the in the West are alternatively too affluent or too precarious to make a revolution. The argument that Western workers are too bought off by the system, that our standard of living is too high for people to take mass radical action, is not a new argument. This was the dominant attitude to Western workers on the left in the 1960s. So just a few weeks before the 1968 general strike in France, a self-described Marxist intellectual, André Gorz, argued that in the Western world there would never be a revolutionary general strike. And this was just a few weeks before there was the largest general strike at the time in world history. So over 10 million workers striking, forcing the president to flee the country and creating a political crisis which came close to developing into a revolutionary situation. So today, sociologists who want to argue workers' revolutions or even class struggle in general is a relic of the past argue that the nature of work has changed, sometimes calling into question the existence of the working class. So some argue that workers are either being replaced by automation and robots, or their work contracts are now so casualised that they are rendered powerless. So, for example, this is like a lineup of people waiting outside an Amazon warehouse. I'm in a job queue. And so that's kind of, that level of precarity is one of the arguments that they kind of make against radical struggle. So even Marxist writers like David Harvey have a pessimistic picture of the working class, arguing, under neoliberalism, the figure of the disposable worker emerges as prototypical upon the world stage. Disposable workers, women in particular, survive both socially and effectively in a world of flexible labour markets and short-term contracts, chronic job insecurities, lost social protections, and often debilitating labour amongst the wreckage of collective institutions that once gave them a modicum of dignity and support. But I would argue that the working class can never be disposed of. While casualisation is a feature of the neoliberal era, it's often overstated, and it can't fundamentally destroy the potential social power of workers. The gig economy, erosion of permanent work, and labour hire might make workers feel powerless and hesitant to take collective action, but it doesn't remove their ability to go on strike. And I have here a slide from a really precarious time. So this is a slide from the 1940s in Sydney, what was called the Hungry Mile. Because many of the unions in Australia were actually built at a time when workers were much more precarious than they actually are today. So the Maritime Union of Australia's predecessor had to confront the bull system in the 1940s, when workers were hired on a day-to-day basis every morning and chosen based on like who looked physically fittest, so like being compared like cattle being inspected for purchase. So leftists today, I think, often forget that historically, precarious employment has been the norm, not the exception, for most of the global working class. And this may present a subjective barrier to workers' confidence in organising, but it can't remove the vital position of workers in the economy and their potential to resist. Similarly, anti-union laws are hardly a new feature of capitalism. While it's right to point out the appalling anti-union laws in Australia today that have effectively made striking illegal, workers have struggled and overcome anti-strike laws in the past by breaking them en masse. And it was confronting this horrific bull system of extreme casualisation and precarity in the 1940s that the precursor to the Maritime Union built one of the strongest unions in Australia. So around the world, the so-called precariat, casual and underemployed workers are proving that they are not simply the victims of neoliberalism. Strike action can bring down Amazon profits crashing to a halt in the 21st century just as much as steel workers brought down the profits of BHP in the 20th century. Our ability to strike gives us not only a social power to raise our conditions and win reforms, but also the potential to transform society and to transform mass consciousness with it. Strikes, and in particular mass strikes, demonstrate to workers the central role they play in creating wealth. They give workers an experience of collective solidarity and self-organisation, and they reveal starkly whose side the state is on in a class struggle. So one of the key arguments that capitalism uses to justify itself is not that the system is great, but that there is no alternative. That our society in all its inequality and violence is merely a reflection of human nature. So radical people can, I think, sometimes become demoralised about the possibility of mass radical action because the majority of people's ideas seem to support the status quo or elements of it. So racist, sexist and homophobic ideas dominate the media and have sunk deep roots into mass consciousness. Aside from deeply prejudiced ideas, the day-to-day experience of deference, subservience, that workers go through makes it difficult to imagine a world run by ordinary people. If millions of people are necessary to make a revolution, how can we convince people out of the garbage ideas that dominate society? That migrants are a threat to our way of life, that women must be treated as baby incubators, that the world's poor don't have the right to flee war and seek refuge. But Marx famously argued that struggle is the great educator. He recognised that while backwards ideas propagated by the 1% might dominate society and even working class life, struggle itself can challenge these ideas. It's no coincidence, for example, that in 1974, a time when Australia had the highest strike rate in the advanced capitalist world, it was also an age where the gay liberation movement was sparked, the women's liberation movement was at its height, and the biggest victories for Aboriginal communities were also won. Revolutions accelerate the education of the working class like nothing else can. Class consciousness, including the conscious solidarity between the oppressed, can progress more in a few months of revolution than in a lifetime of incremental change in a stable society. And this is why Revolutionary Russia had more progressive abortion, divorce and LGBTI laws in 1918 than Australia has today. So in a society where workers run production democratically, seemingly interminable crises could easily be resolved. Global hunger, refugees fleeing for safety, homelessness and economic crises, none of these are the products of a world without resources. They are the product of a system built on exploitation, accumulation and competition. The richest 1% of the world's population control more wealth than the rest of us combined. Expropriating that wealth and reorganising production to abolish the profit motive should be the goal of all socialists. In times of revolution, we've seen glimpses of what a society could look like under workers' control. So in 2011, during the height of the Greek economic crisis, workers whose chemical factory was being shut down decided to occupy and reopen their workplace under their own democratic control. They organised the local working class community to blockade the factory and prevent the former owners from requisitioning the machines and equipment. They consulted the local community about what the factory could produce. And rather than the noxious building chemicals that they had been polluting the neighbourhood with, the workers and community decided to start producing environmentally friendly soaps and detergents. And the building became an assembly point for refugees and once a week a free medical clinic, helping to alleviate the crisis of the Greek healthcare system, which had been destroyed by austerity. So a Guardian writer commenting on the factory was shocked by the solidarity and the creativity of the workers. He said, "A bunch of middle-aged men and women who have spent their entire careers on the wrong end of barked orders about what to do and when to do it have seized ownership over their own workplace and their own working lives. They became their own bosses, and they immediately aligned themselves to the principles of the purest equality possible." And this is just a picture of one of the kind of community assemblies where workers in the kind of local working class neighbourhood would get together and decide the way forward to maintain the occupation and what to do next. But this type of radical experimentation with grassroots democracy can only last when it's generalised across society. An isolated strike or workers' cooperative can't withstand the pressures of the broader capitalist economy or stave off the state for too long. That's why workers' democracy is inseparable from a revolutionary challenge to society. Workers need to take power in every workplace in order to reorganise our economy on the basis of need and cooperation, not profit and exploitation. In social revolutions, workers have started to do this, creating new institutions of workers' power, linking up across workplaces, industries and across borders to reorganise society by seizing the means of production. Russia in 1917... represents the furthest a revolution has gone in achieving workers' power, when for a few brief years, workers kicked out the bosses, ended World War I, liberated oppressed nations, and governed their workplaces on the basis of mass meetings with elected workers' delegates. But you don't have to look back 100 years for examples of workers' democracy in action. In many of the revolutions or near revolutions of the 20th century, similar organs of workers' self-organisation sprang up from the demands of the class struggle. So in France in 1936, the Popular Front Committees, which first sprang up to organise mass strikes, became a form of alternative grassroots organising. In Spain in the same year, the Spanish Revolution and Civil War saw the collectivisation of entire cities and agriculture in parts of the country liberated from a fascist coup. In Hungary in 1956, workers' councils sprang up to challenge the so-called communist state. And in Chile in 1973, the cordones were established in working class communities to reorganise distribution in order to break a boss's strike. And as recently as 2003 in Bolivia, we've seen organs of workers' democracy emerge in revolutionary struggles. So these are just glimpses of workplace democracy. These glimpses of workplace democracy have gone further than the most far-reaching parliamentary reform because they put production in the hands of working people, not the 1% or high-ranking state bureaucrats. I think an important kind of question that reformists are throwing up is whether or not representative democracy removes the question of revolution and insurrection, or the possibility of it. So many on the left argue that the kinds of social crises that ROC countries of the global south cannot emerge in developed economies that have established liberal democracies. But I think that the Yellow Vest movement in France right now is proving that even in the most advanced liberal democracy, class tensions can lead to explosive radical struggle. So for nearly 6 months now, sustained class mobilizations have shaken the Macron government in mass protests, road blockades, and strikes across France. An arrogant neoliberal government has been forced to back down from a series of regressive tax increases, which would have hit the working class. It's also demonstrated the deeply violent nature of the state, and that that's not just a feature of kind of third world dictatorships. The extreme lengths that a so-called democracy will go to in order to suppress the aspirations of the working class. So Macron has unleashed a level of police brutality across France that has not been seen since the last major upsurge of struggle in 1968, with riot police assaulting and injuring thousands of demonstrators and 11 people killed so far. So the Yellow Vest is not a revolution, but it's proven that even in the Western world, working class people can be driven to mass radical action that goes well beyond and challenges the limits of liberal democracy. So social revolutions often emerge first where capitalism and the state is weakest. So I think it's not surprising that a lot of revolutions emerge in some of the poorer countries with dictatorship. But it's not true that they only emerge in authoritarian countries without parliamentary democracy. There have been many revolutionary movements in countries with a long tradition of liberal democracy. France in 1936 reached a period of dual power during a mass general strike, which formed Radical Popular Front Committee. The Spanish Revolution of the same year was unleashed in a country which had been the first in the world to grant universal male suffrage. Chile in the early 1970s experienced a revolutionary situation after the election of a reforming government under Allende. Chile showed that a revolutionary situation could open up in a country which had experienced 140 years of parliamentary democracy. So workers in Chile at first looked to their reforming president, Allende, to lead a challenge to the power of the 1%. After a mass strike wave opened up across Chile, workers began to organise their own grassroots democracy based on working class community meetings. And during a right-wing bosses' strike by truck owners attempting to cripple the Chilean revolution, the workers established cordones to reorganise distribution across Chile, going well beyond what the Allende government was willing to do. The Chilean cordones could see the growing organisation of the right and a coup that was being planned against the Allende government. While they stressed the need for workers' self-activity and militancy in the face of the coup, the Allende reformist government attempted to negotiate and to compromise with the coup plotters, opening the way for counter-revolution. This is an example of one of the marches of the cordones. So Chile in 1973, I think, tragically demonstrates the utter bankruptcy of reformism as a political strategy, but also the alternative. There was a revolutionary alternative on offer. The cordones represented an alternative form of political organisation, one that was beginning to take decisions over production and distribution out of the hands of the bosses of Chile and the multinational corporations. This transfer of power could not happen by decree, or by change to a constitution, changes that the Allende government had promised but could not deliver. It could only be carried out by the revolutionary action of millions of workers. So capitalism is what creates revolutionary crises. Revolutionaries don't make the conditions which lead to revolution. Capitalism does. It's the contradictions in the system which cause economic turmoil, war and social dislocation which give rise to the crises which sometimes erupt into revolution. Any number of things can be the catalyst that finally unleashes built-up discontent into revolutionary struggle. So in Russia in 1917, it was strikes and bread riots on International Working Women's Day. In Tunisia in 2011, it was the self-immolation of a street vendor desperately protesting against police harassment. So these moments are often buried in history, but they are endemic feature of capitalism. Every major transformation in society has required revolutions. The ending of feudalism, the breaking up of monarchies, the abolition of slavery, the end of colonial rule, the overthrow of apartheid. All of these took place not through a process of peaceful legislative reform, but through revolutions made by masses of people. A socialist revolution, one that doesn't simply transfer rule from one minority ruling class to another minority ruling class, but puts power in the hands of the majority, will require even more conscious action, reorganising our entire economy around genuine democracy. Revolution is not on the agenda in Australia today, but we know that capitalism's crises-ridden economy and competition mean revolutions will break out in the future. The organising we do today against the injustices of capitalism must be guided by a vision of what we're fighting for, not just the surface modification of society built on misery, but the total liberation of humanity.